Welcome to Rise, the Choice Machine Music, a new podcast made possible through the generous support of the MSU Federal Credit Union. My name is Julian Chambliss. I'm professor of English and the Val Behrman Curator of History at the MSU Museum at Michigan State University. I'm the lead curator for Techno, the Rise of the Choice Machine Music. This is episode 3, The Machine and the Music. How do you make machine music?
If you think about the sounds, they were making them right up on the fly. That stuff wasn't charted. It wasn't written. But they were great musicians, and so they would come up with different riffs, with guitar, just different things.
That is Stacy Hot Wax Hale talking about the reality of techno music you can never get away from. It's incredibly innovative. It's incredibly different. It's incredibly new. And one of the ways that, as we've seen before, it stands out is because of that innovation, it's hard sometimes for people to associate it with Detroit, especially Black youth in Detroit. One of the things I've asked myself as I was designing the exhibition was, how did African-American youth in Detroit get on the creative path that gets you techno? As we talked about in a previous episode, the city's history and culture is a major part of that. It's a platform, but techno does represent a particular generation of Black youth in dialogue with the world around them. As Rolando Anderson talks about here, what's happening in Detroit is not isolated. It's part of a pattern of Black people engaging in kind of sonic conversation. Each region telling a story about Blackness in conversation with the changing social economic times.
Those were exciting times, late 80s, early 90s, a lot of experimentation. And I think I've told students before, what I miss about that period is we had regional variety. The guys from Texas and the South had a different sound than the guys from the Northeast and the guys from the Midwest and the guys from the West Coast. Each had a certain sound that we could all vibe to. Me coming from the Baltimore, D.C. area, I would talk about Rare Essence and Experience Unlimited and Goat Music and the rap music Techno, well, you know, you had some Detroit and Chicago guys when we had the techno in-house in there.
From an Afrofuturist perspective, one of the things that makes sound Afrofuturist is an intersection. Lyrics, technology, and performance. It's these three things together that highlight an Afrofuturist framework. I want to focus on the idea of the new technology at the core of the techno story. Because no matter how people tell the story, or when they tell the story, they always talk about the tech.
To pair with this, Kikumoto's team also developed the TB-303 baseline. At under $400 US each, this was a very modest price to pay to now have the ability to program and synchronize a rhythm and bass section for a gig, and was marketed as such. Both units even came with their own small gig carry bag.
The Roland 303 is the machine that everybody talks about. The core of techno. It was designed by Tadeo Kikumoro around 1981 for the Roland Corporation. And it was originally designed to simulate the sound of a bass guitar. From the beginning, this new technology offered a challenge to traditional musicians. When we talk about techno and house and the unique sounds that we associate with both.
Although the TR-606 was relatively easy to program, the TB-303 had a rather complex programming nature, where the bass notes had to be entered into the sequencer separately from the note lengths and rests. This made it difficult for artists to program their bass line and led to much frustration, although unintentionally it also made for some great happy accidents.
Those accidents are really crucial when you think about Afrofuturism and techno.
It's really trying to teach that you might actually have learned to think in only one way, and there are other ways of thinking, and you need to do that.
That's Eric Stenkuth talking about Afrofuturism practice. And it's interesting. One of the things that helps define Afrofuturism is in the original definition offered by Mark Derry. He wrote that African-American voices have other stories to tell about culture, technology, and things to come. He urged us to look for Afrofuturism and unlikely places. So for Derry, the definition of Afrofuturism is heavily influenced by the technological transformations birthed by the coming of the internet in the early 1990s. He particularly saw glimpses of this in electronic music. He called attention to figures like George Clinton and Herbie Hancock. Black youth in Detroit shared with these iconic figures an innovative engagement with technology. Ironically, they were doing their innovative work with a product that actually didn't sell that well.
Commercially, the TB-303 and the TR-606 did not sell very well, as they just weren't very practical for their intended use as accompaniment instruments. By 1984, Roland discounted the remaining units drastically to sell them off and end production. Flooding the market with the small, unwanted silver boxes was probably the best thing that could have happened for the budget studio musician creating electronic music in their home. And they found their way into the electronic music studios of those who could breathe new life into these instruments in ways not imagined.
This is John Collins, the community curator for Techno, the rise of Detroit's machine music, and a member of Underground Resistance, talking about the world where Black youth find this equipment and start on the path of creating techno.
Some of these machines came out that didn't utilize them, but when Wyatt Atkins, who we consider the godfather, and these guys knew about these machines and started manipulating them other ways to create this music, because they found a lot of them in pawn shops and people didn't really know what they did or had no use for them. So that's where they bought a lot of that stuff. You could create whatever you want because there was no formula for it. And getting these machines to talk to each other to produce different sounds that they could speak together. And so they had to talk together, and the DJ or producer was able to make up his own recipe or formula for a particular track by utilizing these machines, working them to work together to produce a sound that you didn't think you were going to get, but, oh, that's the right one I want to use. Of course, along with the kicks and the bass and the drums and all of that. So that's basically how it was back in the day. And there were a lot of techno, of course, there were no lyric, there were no vocals.
When I saw the little drum machines, I was a leader of a band, and we would gig around Detroit. I always kept a piece of truck or a van running. So I had to pick up all the guys, you know, get the drummer, keyboard player, Gerald Mitchell, right?
This is Mike Banks, co-founder of Underground Resistance, talking about the disruption created by these new machines.
And somebody came and said, hey, man, I saw a machine at the music store. It's a drum machine. It's like, what? Get rid of the drummer then instead of doing a good enough job. So I did. I bought the machine from Warren Atkins at Fire Ray. And we was doing the gigs with the machine.
Banks' experience highlights the speculative nature of early techno pioneers, making sounds and imagining possible pathways using technology in unexpected ways.
I had a song called Final Frontier that we made, and I was screwing around with it. And a lot of times I used the record method where you just, you know, you try to put it in, and it's weird. That thing beeps on 7. I don't know why. It's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And then it's record. It don't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It's chords at 7, so it's weird. And you're going off of 7. But then once you hook the machines to it, they ain't 4-4. That's kind of sweet right there. And then I just built the track around that.
The experimentation described by Banks opens the door to a recurring question we face as we were outlining the parameters of this exhibition. How do you define techno?
Typically, techno is referenced at 30 beats per minute or more, where it's fast. When it gets too fast, it turns into drum and bass.
This is Stacey Hot Wax Hill.
But it's not to say that a techno song can't be less than 130 and still can hold that title. And so in my opinion, it's the sounds that are used that give you the flavor of giving it a techno flair or not. It still has that sound or whatever that artist decide that, hey, I'm going to make a techno song.
For scholars of Afrofuturism, that unique element to the sound of the machine music is that it captures both the text of the people and the place, but also a spirit that moves beyond the boundaries of what's expected by the listener. Throughout the late 70s and 80s, the expectations for Detroit, especially in the popular culture narrative, were not good. And this is a crucial part of what techno is offering. It's a response at some level to this broader popular culture narrative. Here, Thomas Segrue sketches out what that narrative
look like?
A lot of the pop culture representations of Detroit in this period are ones that are shaped by reactions to the urban uprisings and the Black Power movement. Whites, who are controlling a lot of the popular culture production in the United States in this period, are representing Detroit as this horrific dystopia, a place that's being torn apart by racial violence and rampant crime. And that's a really deep-rooted image. The Motor City in this discourse becomes the Murder City. And so that's one version of Detroit that's making its way into popular culture in the last third of the 20th century in the aftermath of the 60s rebellion. On the other hand, there are a lot of cultural producers, artists, musicians, folks who are beneath the national pop culture radar, who are really diverse. It includes techno, it includes punk, it includes a whole scene that's going on the ground in Detroit, in clubs, in abandoned factories, in neighborhoods that are affordable for people who are engaged in the often not very financially rewarding work of being musicians or artists. And so Detroit attracts a lot of folks, in other words, who see the city as a place where they can practice their creativity, where they can put their ideas into practice. And so there's a really important, really large community of folks who are engaging cultural production in Detroit in the post-Fordist period, in the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s. And increasingly, there are folks who are coming from sometimes far-flung parts of the world to Detroit because they want to be part of this burgeoning underground, or maybe above ground, but often hidden away, often nighttime culture of the city.
So the subculture that Thomas Segrue is talking about really becomes a playground for intricate reimaginings of the Black experience that works explicitly against these expectations of failure that are being imposed on this very Black space. And as someone like Itosha Womack points out, the net result is something that pushes beyond what we understand to be simple reality. It elicits something that is inspirational and transformational for the listener.
The music has this life in it, but it also has this, I don't want to call it dystopianism, but surely like a bit of a surrealism to it.
Technology, from how I understand it coming into the second generation.
That is Carl Craig, a legendary DJ, record producer, and composer, who is generally considered part of the second generation of techno creators, learning from that founding generation and carving their own path in the world. In Craig's case, he worked very closely with Derek May, who would go on to become a prolific collaborator, working with a number of Detroit artists, including figures like Ann Fidler and visual artists like Abdul Kadeem Hawk.
And I've never had this conversation with Juan, but, you know, we interviews with Juan, how he was influenced by the automation, robots, that kind of stuff at the Ford factories that gave him inspiration to think outside the box and make songs like Off the Battle and No UFOs and of that sort.
Craig experience under from the founding generation of techno pioneers highlights how techno documented the city's lived experience. And as Taylor explains, transmitted that to the world.
Those particular sounds are born in Detroit. I would say that because I totally feel like it's taken right off of the assembly line of the repetition of it moving and repeating itself and having a mechanical?
As Stacey Hill points out, that surrealism that Itosha Womack is pointing to is something that is intrinsically unique to Detroit.
And it should have that flair of sound in it. And those particular sounds are born in Detroit. I would say that because I totally feel like it's taken right off of the assembly line of the repetition of it moving and repeating itself and having a mechanical.
Tobias Van Dien really hones in on this idea of the mechanical in his work and really pushes us to consider the ways that machine music is an artifact of the ways that African-American youth are dealing with the transformations associated with the rise of the internet, end of the Cold War, and the emergence of this sort of technologically enhanced future that is so prevalent in our narratives of science fiction. For him, this music creates an opportunity for all those ideas to be thought of in a different light, driven by the creativity of Black people and the considerations of the implications of these kinds of promised technological changes.
Several of these ideas are really picked up by Kajua Shun in the 1990s, who really did a lot of great work thinking about Afrofuturist electronic music and how it alienated the body and brought to the fore a kind of technological flesh continuum that's very late 20th century, and started to think blackness as something that could be transmitted and actually broadcasted.
Kojo Eshun's More Brilliant Than the Sun, Adventures in Sonic Fiction, actually published in 1998. One of the things that Eshun was doing is really calling attention to the ways that this machine-made music created by Black artists is attacking the presumptions associated with how we think about categories.
All these sounds, not only is this like a massive communicative resampling network that's constituting a kind of Pan-Africanist sonic community, that's Paul Gilroy's argument, it's also changing how the world's bodies that hear this sound move in the world.
The idea that Tobias Van Veen suggests here is not just a scholarly abstraction. For many of the people who make the music, machines are important tools for expression, but the need to tell their story transcends the tool, as Carl Craig alludes to here.
Technology, specifically with MIDI instruments, synthesizers, drum machines, et cetera, is the lifeblood of making this music. It is electronic music. It's something that if we didn't have access to 909s and 808s and Juno 106s and SH-101 and Sonic Mirage and all these things from the early days, we would have still found a way to make something incredible. And it would have still been a movement that came out of Detroit that I think that most of us would have been involved with. But maybe we would have substituted the synth with guitars, or substituted with, who knows, an accordion or something.
I think we can see in Detroit a way where new music and a legacy of musical innovation across genre come together. And you can see this in the way that Stacey Hell talks about Amp Fiddler.
So it was very organic, but it stayed funky. And so it kept that rhythm of the funk with it. And that still lives today. And that's what produced Amp Fiddler.
One of the artists that we focused on in exhibition is Amp Fiddler. Amp Fiddler's keyboard is one of the artifacts that we use to highlight diverse, innovative musical culture in Detroit. He was a singer, a songwriter, a keyboardist, a record producer, and he was drawn to electronic music. And he talked about that journey numerous times through interviews. Here's one in 2003.
I started some years ago creating music in a lot of different ways. Through electronic music, I've always bought drum machines, keyboards. I started playing piano as a kid, but electronics always aroused my curiosity. So through the years, I've continued to do that same thing. And I'm just going to move quickly through where I started to where I am now, because we always made demos and created songs through drum machines. Like when I saw you guys working with that 909 yesterday, we bought whatever we can get to try to create music. And just throughout the past 5 years, after years of touring, I've decided to create some music myself. I started sending music to a label in Europe. The conversation came up about the possibility for creating dance music, and I thought, okay, I can do that. Since then, I consider myself an artist first, because being from Motown, I've always been impressed by the history and Motown singers. So I'm like a Motown singer in a sense, but I've also created. They gave me the opportunity to do something that I wasn't doing before, which was electronic music, in a sense of dance music.
Fiddler studied jazz and began his music career touring, but his turn towards electronic music was bridging the gap between established musical tradition and this sort of unique opportunities represented by inventiveness that understands that it has a longer past in the Black musical tradition, but it's also doing something different. It's really key to understanding techno, as Mehta talks about here.
I think even if Fiddler played in P-Funk and then like eventually reaching back to like people like Jay Dilla and Wajid and all that, he was approaching it from a musician standpoint versus, I think in Chicago, a lot of people would just get their hands on sequencers and electronic instruments and then just see what happens.
At the end of the day, as we can hear from these many voices, the machine music that is created in Detroit, it's not just simply about the mechanical creation of sound.
And I think in terms of the sound, it's an interesting sound, right? Techno is not for the faint of heart, and there's a reason for it.
Ultimately, that reason that Amber LaFleur is referring to right there is about creating space to think about Blackness, the future, and the world in a different way. And this is something that Everest Inclus talks about very eloquently.
There are other worlds they have not told you about. And I think that they're opening up to a multiplicity of worlds existing, actually. It's a kind of a speculative way of illustrating that, that different communities have different rules and practices that actually influence how the world is perceived.
What techno captured is that different perspective. Coming from African-American youth in the late 70s and early 80s, the vision they had was steeped in understanding of where they came from, a recognition of the contemporary landscape they faced, but also a commitment to a future that was better. And really, that becomes a core to what makes the machine music so appealing, not just simply in Detroit, but around the world. Thanks for listening. In the next episode, we're going to dig into the DJ, their role as innovators, instigators, and inventors in the story of techno. If you want to learn more about the machines behind techno, check out Exhibit 3000, curated by John Collins. Exhibit 3000 does a great job of telling the story of techno in Detroit using artifacts from the people who created the music. Visits are by appointment only, so visit www.submergedownload.com/Exhibit 3000 to learn more about scheduling your visit.